Welcome back to Ponderosa Ponders. As always, it's Rockwell Peterson.
And Isaac Wilhelmy.
And joining us in the studio today, a good friend of mine.
It's Gabe Snyder.
Awesome. We're here to talk about carbon emissions and atomic power. Let's get started. Okay. So, Gabe, as far as carbon emissions and atomic power goes, do you have any opening thoughts, a stance on it you'd like to take?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's very much an important issue. I think there's a lot of stigma and taboo attached to a lot of the ideas behind behind nuclear energy as a whole.
Yeah.
And especially right now, amidst a very serious, the climate crisis, where we really, it's so imperative right now, as quickly as possible, to be able to cut the amount of emissions the amount of carbon we're putting in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really become, in the last several years or decade or so, very much an important topic in, public and political and just in discussion in general.
Absolutely.
About the issue.
Yeah.
As
yeah.
to how we're going to realistically be able to provide enough energy to provide for our needs as a society, but also without pumping massive amounts of carbon into the atmosphere, which is, in the long term, very disastrous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's fair. Nuclear energy does have its problems. I can definitely get behind using it, but I think we need to invest more research into how we're going to store the radioactive, byproducts. You know, the basically nuclear runoff that, for now, we're just kind of sticking in tanks and putting underground, which is not a good idea. Not a good idea, because those tanks last, at most 30 years before they start degrading slowly?
Yeah, it has to be, it's a very expensive and very difficult thing to do, and in the long term, it's not very feasible. So it's very much a massive logistical issue that's just a nightmare to try and
absolutely.
Think about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think part of what we're overlooking is the fact that I believe some European countries are actually now switching over to thorium. So they're using thorium instead of uranium.
There's sort of a discussion around that idea, and it's very much just a topic of discussion at the moment.
I think a couple of power plants are actually doing it.
India in particular, they have one reactor they've converted that is starting to try and use thorium fuel. And the fascinating thing about, and thorium in particular has come up a lot recently, and I find it a very, very important, very fascinating concept of replacing, because thorium is a fertile heavy metal. So it's not fissionable, but it's fertile, so it's very easy to pick up an extra
electron,
proton, and so that it can actually be fissile. And I think it's thorium-232 is the isotope.
I believe so.
Or 233 is fissile, and 232 is the isotope that is very commonly found in nature.
Yeah.
And so, yes, the whole concept of, and recently, there's a whole lot of issues associated with, in general. There's a lot of very, people are scared of the whole concept of using, nuclear fission as a way to generate heat and electricity, mostly because of, in terms of, a lot of people are scared of how safe that is. The whole process, people, think of the disasters at Chernobyl and Fukushima and, to an extent, at Three Mile Island as well.
Absolutely.
And it's basically just a scary thought.
Yeah.
So people are scared that we can't make that fission process safe enough to be yes, we can trust that nothing is ever going to go wrong with any of these reactors. And I think second big issue is the waste currently. The waste stream is massive.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's not an issue that's ever going to go away.
Yeah.
And third, I think the other scary thing that people think about most is proliferation. Any of this material that we're using in these reactors were to ever be able to be used in a weapon, it'd be absolutely disastrous.
True. Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things. First, with atomic power, at least, and then we can get on to carbon emissions.
Yeah.
I think they need to move them farther away from high population density areas, period. I get it. The longer that the electricity travels, the more you lose to the wiring and...
Yeah, you there's loss in the resistivity of it. Yep.
And then I think the way we fix that is by investing in better battery research, you know, like getting better batteries that are more efficient at storing larger amounts of power for longer.
Yeah, power storage in general. Yeah.
Because there's only so much we can do with transportation. But if we can have, you know, large, efficient batteries at checkpoints along the way, we can stop a lot of that immediate loss, especially if it's not being used and is just kind of cycling.
Yeah, like and then, relays that can store power.
And exactly. And then, other than that, finding a better storage unit for it, investing more into thorium, and maybe looking into, you know, graphene maybe as a storage or some other metals that and compounds that we could use better for storage capabilities.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I would definitely agree with that. I think one thing that I found fascinating, because there's a lot of issues that are just really... I think there's a lot that people don't quite realize and a lot that people don't know about a lot of the research and development that has gone into a lot of the trying to tackle all the engineering problems associated with modern fission reactors. And it's very, very fascinating to look at. A lot of the issues caused today are basically inherent physical attributes or flaws in a sense of the whole idea of a uranium-fueled, water-cooled fission reactor in the first place. Yeah. And back in like the late 40s and early like the 1950s, when a lot of this whole field of research was just developing, and there's a lot of money going into this as well, like national laboratories who were researching a lot of these issues were very, very well funded, and they actually had the ability to go and do their research and build the different, expand their laboratories and build the reactors they needed to test a lot of different ideas. And I think a lot of the problem that it kind of stems from today is a lot of money went into reactors for the Navy, and I believe it was back in 1956 that the first nuclear submarine was launched, and the whole concept that essentially is embodied in most modern commercial power reactors is a very small-scale, uranium-fueled, highly enriched uranium at that water-cooled reactor. And that's works very, very well and efficiently on a nuclear submarine where you have plenty of water to circulate, and it's a very small scale, and you can make those comfortably safe.
Yeah.
Well,
to some degree. Yeah,
But there's so much money went into developing a reactor that could fit in a submarine like that. They said, well, we've already put all this money and all this research into this design and this idea. Why would we try and... We should invest more money in trying to expand upon this rather than... What other ways can we extract energy from heavy metals like uranium and thorium and plutonium? And how can we produce fission more efficiently, safer, and overall better? And so throughout, the 50s and 60s, a lot of research went into, all of the first power reactors that we saw here in the UK and the States and throughout Europe and China and the USSR. Is you see the consistent theme of just building upon that original concept of you have enriched uranium fuel and water-cooled reactors, which pressurized and boiling water reactors everywhere, because the science was proven, and you didn't have to put a whole lot of money into developing anything new. You just had to build the reactor. And so there wasn't as much incentive at that point to try and explore other concepts for how do we generate power. And so all over the world, we see back in the 50s and 60s, lots of money going into building these commercial power reactors. Our electricity here in the United States, and over a lot of parts of the world, we still get a fifth of our electrical power all over the country exclusively from these nuclear reactors that were built in the 50s and 60s and to an extent the 70s, and we haven't built any new ones since, which is concerning anyway.
Just a bit.
Yeah.
But all of the issues associated with safety, because the inherent flaw in all of these reactors, what you saw at Chernobyl, it was a pressurized uranium-fueled pressurized water reactor. Fukushima, which is the exact same deal, but the inherent issue with this is you have a fission reaction going on, generates lots of heat, and the way to extract that heat is you have to have water flowing through that reactor vessel literally throughout the entire life of the reactor, or whenever it's running, certainly. And so the issue you run into is you have to have like 100% fail-safe pumps and systems to keep that water flowing, which is a huge issue. If you don't have that, like what happened at Chernobyl, mm-hmm. is heat built up too much, and they didn't realize ahead of time it wasn't a pump yeah. issue, but they ran out of water. Like, the water just boiled away, mm-hmm. and the reactor didn't have any way to cool it. Reaction got out of control, got too hot, melted right through the containment yeah. vessel. Fukushima was the same deal. They just lost power. There's no water flowing there. 3 Mile Island was the same. It didn't quite melt down, but it was very, very close to. And so there's that inherent risk of, if anything, like, we can make these, we can have, you know, as many backup generators as we want, as many safety mechanisms. And today we've, there are a lot of innovations that have
helped.
Essentially established yeah. a passive safety, but it's very, very expensive to do in a complex reactor like that. It requires water as the coolant and the moderator all the time. But in terms of safety, back in the mid-1960s, over at Oak Ridge National Labs, I think they had a facility out in Idaho, and Argonne took over later with this project, but it was the concept of it was called the Experimental Breeder Reactor 2, and the idea was very, very different from what you know, we see in commercial power reactors
yeah.
today. The idea was, and it kind of ties into the idea of modern research and ideas surrounding a molten salt reactor
mm.
and using thorium fuel, is you have or is very small scale, but the idea was you build a reactor that you use uranium fuel, but also it has liquid or molten sodium salt as the coolant and the moderator. There's no water involved. So the idea here
mm-hmm.
and it was later developed throughout the 1980s as the Integral Fast Reactor Project. And the fascinating thing here is the design of this reactor was such that not only was it very, very efficient, like far more efficient than any water-cooled reactors at the time and since, but you have the idea of, you have your containment vessel with your
yeah.
uranium fuel and pellets and rods just
yeah.
normally in this particular design. But as you generate heat from the reactor, from the fission, it melts this kind of jacket of flowing molten sodium salt, which has a very, very high melting temperature, and it acts as a moderator just like water. But the very fascinating thing about this is when you have a material with such a high melting point, like
yeah.
sodium salt,
mm-hmm.
is what happens when you say, in the event of a massive accident like what happened at Chernobyl,
yeah,
and it has, you know, it's, of course, you use water to extract the heat from that to generate power, mm-hmm. but the primary coolant is that sodium salt. And so what happens is when that, if, say, you ever run into an issue where the reactor is
yeah.
running, there's the fission process is going on, and you have, say, you lose your water pumps.
Yeah.
Like, there's no power to the pumps, they break down, anything like that happens. Or in the event that you can't control that reaction anymore, it just gets out of control and you can't pump
yeah.
enough water in. So either the fission reaction gets out of control, gets too hot, or you lose water and it just gets too hot and melts through the containment vessel. What happens, and they tested this, is, I'm trying to oversimplify,
You're good.
This as much
I
as possible
I
without
it.
Ranting
yeah.
too long.
No, absolutely.
But the concept is, and a lot of research went into it, of course, but in April 1986, actually, it's so weird to think, because it was only a few weeks before the reactor Chernobyl
yeah.
melted down. They invited public figures and physicists and all very... and scientists from all over
yeah.
the world to come to Idaho to witness some tests that they were running and had been planning for some time. And what they did is they ran two tests, and they essentially what they did is they cut off all power. There's no more water pumps. There's no way for the reactor to reject its heat. It just keeps getting hotter and hotter, and
yeah.
they don't stop the reaction, and they just sit back and let that happen.
Yeah.
And so in a normal reactor like that, if you, you know,
everyone dies.
Reactor,
everyone
yeah,
dies.
It just melts down. What happened is, in a reactor like this, when heat starts building up and the reaction accelerates, that the sodium salt, the coolant, it actually
basically insulates it, keeps it all within, and channels it outward slightly.
Sort of. It. Yes. To put it simply.
To put it simply is what
exactly.
I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not, like, I understand
exactly.
that it's far more complex than that.
Yeah.
But in order to simplify it, it basically acts as an insulation
mm-hmm.
that catches most of it with a high melting point, prevents it from completely melting down and killing everyone in the area, giving them
precisely,
more time.
Precisely, yeah. It doesn't allow anything to fully melt. And it's super complex, but the idea is the reaction, it the heat rises very, very, you know, the, gets very, very hot quickly, but it never physically can't get hot enough to ever, you know, melt through any of the the reactor vessel. And so what happens is once it reaches that peak, the reaction just naturally slows down and shuts itself off completely. So there's no physical way for that sort of reactor cooled by molten salt to ever get hot enough to melt down. So there's no way for anything like what happened at Chernobyl or Fukushima to ever happen, no matter, like, no matter what. So basically, we have this this design that was built and proven that proves that we can harness fission without having a reactor meltdown like that.
Well, one thing, one concept that I like to play with before we go to ad break quick is cold fusion. That's a really interesting concept to me, and the amount of power we can get from that quite safely is something that really, really interests me. Now, the mechanics of it are, of course, difficult, but we're still working on it, and I'm not entirely sure if we have working prototypes or not yet, but I know that it's definitely in development, and we're working on it.
Yes, there's a lot of time that has to go into a lot of
safety,
a lot of technical issues that are associated with it, but it's something that is a very real possibility in the not too distant future.
Yeah,
it's going to take a lot more yet, but that's something that's very, very fascinating that we really need to spend a lot of time and money on.
Absolutely. Yeah, when we get back, we'll move on to the topic of carbon emissions. Stick around. And we're back. So to basically wrap up before we move on to carbon emissions, as far as the waste stream goes with fission reactors, you and I were just having a short conversation about it, but I definitely think that if we can work on some better storage for it, if we can work on maybe some fuel reprocessing, and if we can find a way to feasibly store it somewhere. Because if we're going to use water-cooled reactors, some people are like, yeah, let's send it into space. I don't think that's a good idea. Let's put our radioactive things in our atmosphere. You know what's going to come down? That's basically an intercontinental ballistic missile coming down at you that's radioactive.
Yeah, so you want to put like multiple tons of very heavy radioactive materials. How expensive is that?
The amount of fuel you'd have to burn just to put it up there.
Yeah,
like, it's a complete waste of time. But something that I think we can do is explore the Mariana Trench. Because, like, how far down could you drop this thing and just let it sit in a water-cooled environment, super compressed? Like, even if it does start reacting, like, the amount of compression down there is going to hold it in this small little bubble ball. Mm. And, like, even if it does go off, I put this in heavy quotations, it's going to be so far down that it's going to be completely cycled through the... People don't realize how massive the ocean is.
Yeah.
Like, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying we should encourage pollution of the oceans.
Yeah.
But safe storage in small design pods to allow it to compress and store it.
Mm.
You basically stick it in a tin can of, like, metals at the bottom of the Mariana Trench.
That reminds me of a very interesting story. Can we take a short sidetrack here a little bit?
Absolutely.
So, fascinating thing that I found out fairly recently is... I think it would have been about 2 billion years ago, but there are actually, and I think there's actually multiple locations where this has been discovered, but there existed at one point for a matter of, like, I think a few hundred thousand, a few million years, a quote-unquote natural fission reactor.
Like, jeez.
It's fascinating. Yeah. So back when a lot of these elements were, like, still in the Earth's crust, and... they hadn't as much time to decay to where they are now, but the enrichment you need for uranium-235 to fission, you need to have about 2-3% uranium-235. We have about like less than about 0.7% of the richest deposits that we have here in the Earth's crust of your for uranium deposits. But 2 billion years ago, that percentage was actually higher, at about 3 or 4%. So fission was in theory capable. So a lot of these deposits, what happened is when for fission to occur, you need a moderator to slow down the neutrons so that when they hit another atom of U-235, it'll fission. So what happened, I forget the name of the place, but in Africa, and there are a few other like small places where this has been proven to have happened, there were a uranium deposit, and there is like some rock or like soil that was permeable enough to water so that there was like an underground sort of river, essentially, where water could flow through. So what happens is you have these deposits, ancient deposits of uranium that was just enriched enough. So when you have water that flows through, the neutrons produced when like one atom fissions are slowed down enough so they can hit another one and cause a chain reaction. And what happens is it's basically the physics behind a modern fission reactor, but it's just naturally occurs. Yeah. So you have, of course, it just like fission created heat, which is all that happens. But for millions of years, as water flows through there, like there's actually a consistent fission chain reaction. So, well, kind of in the Mariana Trench, like, probably not going to happen.
Like, I just thought it was a funny thought experiment. Exactly. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, if we're looking for solutions, might as well have some fun with it. Exactly. Like, could you imagine just boom, boom? But all joking aside, they did actually find nuclear glass in the Saharan Desert.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, it probably would have been in that general.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it was in that area and actually helped create the desert, because that would make sense. You know, like a fission reaction naturally occurs. All this
radiation probably kills a lot of stuff.
But switching from that, as far as desertification goes, you know, like segue there. I think that it's like, part of combating carbon emissions, I think, reversing the effects of desertification in a lot of areas would help a lot.
Yes, it has a massive impact.
Yeah, because I believe the snow stores CO2. You know, so like with the melting glaciers, a lot of CO2 is being released, which is not helping.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's also causing sea levels to rise. Isn't it going to... I want to say it's going to predicted to rise like 50, 60 meters here's... You know, in the next 100 years.
Yeah, the big thing with like Arctic sea ice is like it's a massive, massive area of the surface of the Earth. So what happens is, you know, that ice reflects, you know, thermal energy very, very well. So it just reflects it back into space. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But when that ice melts, the ocean will just absorb that energy and get warmer and warmer.
Yeah.
But, you know, relatively small amounts, but on a large scale, that's really bad. Yeah. And how dependent, like people don't realize, it's not just the idea of global warming. Like, people think like, oh, well, if the world gets like a couple degrees warmer, it's not that big deal, like big of a deal. But people don't realize it's much more complex than that. And the whole thing is like, if you raise the ocean temperature by just a degree or two, like it's such a fragile system of ocean currents, which affect wind and weather patterns. That's the whole reason like Europe is still warm, because of not the Gulf Stream, but the North Atlantic.
The trade winds.
Yeah, the trade winds. The Gulf Stream, which makes, you know, a lot of the United States, you know, have the climate that it does.
Yeah.
Not to mention, if you heat up the ocean, it's going to take forever to go back.
Yeah, to cool it down.
Yeah. It's very cool.
No, absolutely. And I think some of the things we could do to help with that is, you know, because we have vessels making ice and trying to replenish that, you know, glacial. Mm-hmm. We do.
You remember that Simpsons sketch? Simpsons.
Yeah. The Simpsons predict a lot. It's weird, but we right so now, weird. Like, oh, no. If Kim Jong-un dies and his sister takes over, Simpsons are right again. But we have submarines actually making ice at
the
poles
right
now.
They think
this is a good idea. They are doing it. I'm not here to debate good ideas. I'm stating the simple fact that we're doing it. Okay, I'm not here to get into the like debate of is this a good idea.
I don't
I'm just
even
saying
know
they're
how
doing
to, how to respond. You're
good.
To
I don't
this.
I don't want to approach this quite yet. Like I think we have other things to focus on as far as carbon emission. Like it's a broad spectrum, but I just thought you would get a kick out of that. We are just like we just basically have giant ice makers right now, just kind of like.
This is a viable solution.
There we go. But I think reversing, you know, like really working on reversing some of the effects of desertification could also, you know, not only help Africa as a whole, but it would also help a lot in the processing of CO2 in our atmosphere. And I've been really surprised by, you know, quarantine and social distancing, because I read an article that the ozone layer closed. You know, look it up for yourself. Was, the largest hole in the ozone layer closed just because humans stayed inside for a month. Now, I'm not going to say anything, too bad about humans. I'm just going to say Chernobyl is doing better now that we're all gone. Us just going away for a month The Earth is already bouncing back pretty heavily. Yeah. So I would honestly support, I've talked about this a little bit before, I'd honestly support like yearly just taking 1 month of social distancing, where it's just like, doesn't matter if everyone's sick or not. Let's just take, you know, the average flu season. Everyone just, not even quarantines, but just social distances. Everyone just kind of chills.
Yeah. Not for humanity, but
for the earth. For the environment.
Yeah, just the total earth. Amount of energy just decreases because people aren't, you know.
So yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
A really interesting quote. You know our mutual friend Eli.
Oh, I do. I'm trying to get him on the show, so that should be a lot of fun.
If we could all get together, we could have a
we've already done one on our political beliefs, but I'd love to bring you guys on and just watch the Madhouse interview. Like, that would be so much fun.
Me and Eli have gotten so close.
You want to talk about the conversations between you, me, and Eli? Oh, it's a have you ever heard of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse? We are the three horsemen of complete social breakdown. Oh, like, God, it is bad.
But we digress. I think it was very fascinating. I remember he had shared a bit about how I think the Vatican recently used to advocate against like gas lighting. So a lot of people like, stay up all night and whatnot. Yeah. Cities, you know, stay, you know, busy and
open.
Whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, you know, Las Vegas is famous, you know, the city that never sleeps.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating, I forget who had said it or if it was a passage from maybe the Bible or a book, but just the idea of the city that never sleeps receives no rest. And maybe the idea of, hey, you know, a lot of, you know, nightlife in cities, it's nice people like, go out to the clubs and whatnot, but, you know, the idea of like, taking a month off.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe even just, you know, at night, there's so much activity, you know, it demands a lot of energy and whatnot at night in big cities. Like, what if we just, like, shut down cities at night? And American cities are, and, you know, especially, like, well, modern cities in general are, you know, infamous for being, like, constantly.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there is no silence. But if you say, like, took the option, like, okay, so, like, after 10 p.m. until, like, 6 a.m., there's very, very limited activity. And the amount of time that would add up to, say, however many hours a day, that's like a quarter. That's like taking a quarter of the year for like a big city like Los Angeles to just most like shut down for the
just
most
chill.
Part, and not, you know, produce so much, need so much energy and produce so much carbon.
Well, it's like that's not a bad idea. Don't get me wrong, but I think it's a lot easier to convince people, hey, take a month off, as opposed to hey, don't do anything at night. Like I feel like we already try to push that a
bit. Or balance it, you know, like a rotating absolutely. Sort of. Yeah, exactly.
But that's what I'm saying, where it's like, it's not that hard to start traditions. And so if we just institute a tradition where it's like, hey, you know, our economy will plan for it, nothing will really like shut down, but everyone just kind of take a break.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Just take, I think that'd be good for all of us mentally.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Definitely.
And not only mentally, but it'd be good for the environment and could actually solve a lot of problems that so far we've thought was unsolvable. I remember everyone freaking out, oh, how are we going to close the ozone layer? Well, stay home for a month.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. That's legitimately it. Everyone stay home for a month. Large cities are seeing the skies again. There's like they're getting
that's
to see
so
the
crazy
stars.
The before and after photos. Like,
oh, it's
it
insane.
Is a huge difference.
Yeah. And I think part of it is, like I had stated previously, I think working on complete combustion.
Yeah.
If we invest more into complete combustion, I think would help a lot.
Yeah.
You know?
It really would.
Because not only could complete combustion be more useful in cars, but imagine in coal plants.
Yeah.
Imagine in, you know, electrical plants. Because a big draw of atomic power is not only how much energy it can make, but that it's clean.
Exactly.
What if we could make coal clean? And it's like, in the meantime, even if we can't get complete combustion, though it's feasible.
Yeah, in the very, very short term, like, we can, it's very something that's very easy to do.
Yeah.
Like, a practical solution we can use right now to try and just reduce the total amount of carbon we're putting in the atmosphere.
Absolutely.
Very, very fascinating idea is most modern cars can be refitted very easily to burn not just gasoline, but very much cleaner fuels like... Or even just, you know, redesign of certain, like, already existing concepts behind combustion engines is you can burn, like, methanol, fuels that produce much less carbon exhaust.
Yeah.
And it would be something we could do right now, just use a different fuel. So an immediate solution we could start working on.
Well, it's interesting because some scientists I read were actually working on making biofuels out of hydroponic systems and moss. And so they were able to take, you know, like moss and a lot of stuff that grows in swamps and turn it into a biofuel very easily. It grows very quickly. It is very, you know, you've seen a swamp, very green, very alive.
Exactly.
And so they're able to turn that into a biofuel very, very easily that burns pretty clean. And so not only that, but as we work on complete combustion, I think another solution is filtration systems. You know, because we have some essence of, you know, filters and carburetors on cars.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what would help even more is if we were able to stick a filter on, say, the exhaust of cars and factories. You know, factories, coal factories, energy plants, where it catches a lot of the carbon and the harmful chemicals that would be released by some of these reactions. And then, you know, you can extract the carbon to use in, say, commercial industries, you know, repurpose the carbon into making different things.
Yeah.
And then it's not that difficult, especially with the evolution of CRISPR now, to create microbacteria that would be able to live on these filters and just eat a lot of the harmful things, harmful byproducts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would solve a lot of our issues and is completely within the realm of reason.
Exactly, and with a lot of, like, ideas and just solutions like that, they're not some, like, oh, well, we can, this is like some sort of pie-in-the-sky dream that, oh, we can maybe do this one day. It's like, no,
this is
actually something we
feasible.
Can do now.
Yeah, right now. And, I just think considering more things like that could definitely help with the carbon emissions issue as a whole. Look, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show, Gabe.
Yeah, thank you very much.
We'd love to have you back. We'd love to keep talking about this with you. Thank you for coming on. If you guys want to reach us right before, you know, we'll go into closing statements in just a sec. But if you guys want to reach us, we'd be happy to have you on the show. We'd love to hear your questions and answer them.
Yeah.
We'd love to take your, you know, show ideas. We'd just love to hear from you. And
yeah, just feedback.
Yeah, it's so great to hear from you guys. We can't thank you guys enough for tuning in.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to, you know, reach out to us. You can find us on Instagram at Ponderosa_Ponderers. We'd love to hear from you. You can also email us at PonderosaPonderers@gmail.com. And, yeah, any closing statements? No?
No.
Pretty much.
Catch you on the flip side.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure there's a lot more we could go into.
Oh,
but,
yeah, for sure.
We'll call it here.
Call it
for
good
now.
For today.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tune in next time, I guess.
Absolutely. And don't forget, keep pondering.